At the beginning of the new year, many of you have probably resolved to take on a new challenge, like starting a business, changing careers, launching a creative project. Whatever your goal is, it's going to need a web page. And doesn't matter if you need a landing page, a professional blog, an online store. Squarespace allows you to create a custom platform where you can make your latest goals into a reality. So start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED, that's C-R-A-C-K-E-D, to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, make your next move. Hey guys, all right, let's think about the most puzzling dream you've ever had. Do you want to know what that dream means? Well, so do Chris Gethard and Gary Richardson. That's why they've teamed up with Wyatt Cenac, Bobby Moynihan, and Aparna Nancharla to take a crack at figuring out your most bizarre dreams in their new improv comedy podcast, In Your Dreams. So subscribe to In Your Dreams on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. Again, In Your Dreams, it's a very funny podcast.
Yeah. We got London on the track.
This is all God's doing, man, you can't plan it. But if the devil's in the details, then I'm satanic. About to take over your city and you can't stand it. My accountant say you sinking like the Titanic. David Blaine last summer, man, you had to vanish.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Crack Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked. And this week, we're listening to Sneakin' by Drake, featuring 21 Savage, which is a dope song produced by London on the track. And it's appropriate because the hook talks about not being able to afford mistakes. And today we're talking about mistakes and accidents that happened behind the scenes of famous movies and video games and musical recordings, as the kids call them. You cop that latest musical recording, son? As the kids say, these are mistakes that not only actually made their way into iconic works of pop culture, they actually are what made them great in a lot of cases. This is a thing that's not peculiar to art, actually. A lot of the biggest breakthroughs in science and human history happened by accident. Columbus thinking the world was smaller than it was leads to the New World. He was uniquely wrong about that, by the way. Somehow it came down to us that he was the only person who realized the world wasn't flat. And the truth is, everyone knew it was round and actually had a pretty good sense of how big it was, except for Columbus. He thought it was, I think, roughly the size of a largish beach ball, and that he could just kind of hook around back and end up in India. And he was wrong in the most fortuitous way possible. I think we've mentioned before how the use of laughing gas, which was one of the early anesthetics, was a complete accident. Prior to laughing gas, your options for surgery were get really drunk before they saw it into you, or deal with it, I guess, bite down on something. I think I read in a primary source one time that if you walked by a hospital that had operating rooms, you could actually hear the screaming from out on the streets. And the thing that brought an end to that horrifying carnival of terrors was some dude who liked to party so much, in fact, that he invented this new way to party where he would fill up tents with nitrous and everyone would get together and, you know, laugh their dicks and tits right off their bodies. And at one point during one of these parties, somebody laughed too hard and like tripped over something, broke their leg gruesomely, and just stood up and walked across the room on a leg that was bending the wrong way. And that's how they figured out that it was good for stopping pain. Anyways, art history is full of people who didn't know what they were doing when what they were doing was creating these singular, brilliant, seemingly meticulously planned works of art. My favorite movie, Jaws, was largely based on mistakes, as we'll discuss. My favorite rock song growing up, Sweet Child of Mine. My favorite genre of music, rap, was a total accident. The various influences were all present in New York City. There was like reggae and dance hall music and disco, but there was nothing to bake them into a casserole that would like kind of turn them into one cohesive art form. And then lightning struck, not as in someone had a good idea, like literal lightning struck three parts of the New York electricity grid that were, I guess, specifically vulnerable parts, and they all got struck in the same night. And on top of that, some systems operator at Con Edison failed to flip the switches in the right order on his control board to, you know, properly distribute the load. And New York City was plunged into 25 hours of darkness. Probably not all 25 hours were dark. I'm sure there was some daytime mixed in there. But that happened to be a time of a lot of racial and social unrest, which led to a shitload of looting, which led to a bunch of really expensive stereo equipment being injected into the streets, which allowed for a lot of block parties in the coming years where people could mix all those different genres of music together. That's how the most vital art form of the last couple decades was born. Not just one accident, but 1,000 unpredictable, unplannable coincidences. And 17 years later, we get Illmatic. Anyways, those are the big broad stroke accidents that kind of created the modern pop culture landscape. We're going to talk about some more specific errors that created stuff you always assumed was the way it was on purpose. So I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you guys then.
Niggas keep reaching and dissing. Can't afford mistakes, not on this end. Let me call my bros for assistance. You gon' make me call my bros for assistance. Niggas keep reaching and dissing. Put me in a fault up position. Let me call my bros for assistance. Let me call my bro. No. I don't need love, I'm the GOAT. I just hit the beat and float. And I'm selling out arenas, but you putting on a show.
All right, I'm joined by Alex Schmidt, Schmitty the Clam.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you doing, man?
I'm great.
Yeah. Good. And I'm also joined by Teresa Lee.
Hey, I need a nickname.
Teresa the Clam?
I don't like that. No, not at all. Take it back.
It's just all my only mode.
Right.
So we recently had an article about how there are certain roles that were designed for specific actors that aren't the actors who ended up playing them. Like My Cousin Vinny was supposed to be Andrew Dice Clay. The whole idea was like this tough New York guy comes down and like that's Andrew Dice Clay's whole thing. And Sarge actually had a column where he was talking about like complaints that we have and then the other sides to the coin, the sort of silver linings to those complaints. And he was pointing out that while it seems these days like pop culture has gotten very cynical and like everything's just, you know, focus grouped and like they're aiming at a demographic and they know that Star Wars is going to make this much money. When you look at actual huge pop culture hits, most things actually happen by complete accident. And so that's what I wanted to look at, sort of some of the accidents behind the scenes of iconic pop culture that created these things that we sort of take for granted as, oh, these were just acts of genius.
With that My Cousin Vinny one, in that article, there's also a thing about how Alan Grant in Jurassic Park was definitely supposed to be Harrison Ford. It felt like my eyes were opened when I read it. Like, oh, obviously, he's wearing an Indiana Jones hat
right.
And going on Indiana Jones adventures on a dinosaur island.
And is annoyed by children.
Right.
And has a younger blonde girlfriend. But I feel like that would have been maybe too on the nose. Or
yeah.
Yeah, it would have felt like an Indiana Jones movie. Hey, we can make Indiana Jones in the 90s now. It would have been like weird.
Well, it's almost like that becomes now just a trope character because more actors have played it. Like originally it was just a Harrison Ford movie, but now that we have that precedent, now we can be like, oh, that's just a type of character movie we would see. So it's opened up a whole new door.
That's a really good point. Harrison Ford made a big mistake by turning it down because now anybody can be that guy. And when they were first deciding to make Indiana Jones, that is an archetypal character from the 50s, this adventurer who like goes through rainforests, and back when it started it was super racist, I'm sure, like, and teaches the locals how to live like not savages. That was an archetypal character. There's like a lot of old movies that you can look at where people are dressed like Indiana Jones and have Indiana Jones hats and like whips and, you know, adventuring around. And they just kind of lazily remade that without getting the rights to any of those movies.
Yeah, isn't it? I think there's something on our site where it points out how it's Raiders of the Lost Ark is all based on, I want to say it's a Charlton Heston movie. Or like, it's just everything he does in the movie is a ripoff.
Yeah, it is. We've actually covered this, I think, in the past with regards to music. We had my friend Pete, who was in the band The Walkmen, on, and we were talking about just like the stories behind music. And there's a story about Elvis's first recording session. There was this like storied thing where he went in and recorded a song for his mom, and that's how he was discovered. Right. So he sang a song for his mom. They were like, oh, this guy's got a decent voice. Let's bring him in for a session like 2 years later. They just happened upon his demo. And they had 3 hours of just bullshit. They were just like, this guy sucks. And then like he started doing this voice as a joke that was like an exaggerated voice. And that became the Elvis voice. It was like a joke. Everybody was just kind of like goofing around. Huh. And I was reminded of that doing research for this episode because Stanley Kubrick, the way that he got the performances in Dr. Strangelove.
Right, I saw that.
You know, he was like, just for warm-ups, just for funsies, do the most ridiculous version of this character that you could possibly think of. And then we'll shoot the real version. And told them that the cameras weren't rolling, and so they like did these over the top things just jokingly, like, what's the worst version of this you could do? Let's like crack each other up. And that ends up being the over the top Dr. Strangelove performance.
Well, one of them also didn't know it was a comedy, right?
They were all playing it in this like dignified way, and humans have dignity. That's a problem with humans. When you're making art out of humans, they have dignity. And so in order to get past that, you have to make these accidents happen. The set of The Exorcist, there was genuine like evil going on in terms of like how the director was treating people. He just had a handgun the whole time and would just fire it into the air at random intervals just to like keep people terrified and like sort of worn out. And then like he did things like actually like beat up the small woman who was playing Regan in like a lot of those scenes. And the vomit scene, the guy was expecting it to hit his chest and like he like secretly aimed it at his face so like he wouldn't. It's just like a lot of the stuff that you assume is like all carefully planned is actually people fucking with each other or doing things by accident. I think the classic example is Jaws, right?
Yeah, isn't it that it was called Bruce, it was the mechanical shark, and it didn't work properly. So then they just had to throw out a bunch of shots where the shark was going to be swimming around and doing stuff and very visible. So then they ended up with this feeling of, where's the shark? We rarely see it.
The shark had a lot of lines in the first version of the script. He was a major character. No, but like during the attack scenes, like you saw the shark in the first version of the script, and they just had to throw it out because they put it in the water for the first time, the mechanical shark, and it sank to the bottom of the ocean. They're like, are you fucking kidding me? And so the full body mechanical shark, like, they didn't have anymore. And so, yeah, they just had to like do things like signal an attack by having the camera come up to people and then like making the water red.
I like to imagine the mechanical shark builder, after they threw out his stuff because it didn't work, he's like, well, let's see you make a movie without me.
Right,
and then
yeah.
He goes and sees it and it's Jaws. It's
right. But it's so much of it is like just staring failure in the face without flinching and just having the balls to like say something crazy like, well, what if we just never show the shark for the first 90 minutes of our shark movie? Or like, Annie Hall was originally a spoof of a murder mystery because romantic comedies weren't really a genre back then. And the murder mystery was a fucking mess. The movie was like 5 hours long. And they were like, what if we cut out the murder from our murder mystery and made a movie with all the stuff that's left over behind? And yeah, it doesn't make sense. So we'll tell it out of order. And that becomes Annie Hall. Good Will Hunting, originally, Matt Damon like got recruited by the CIA and there was like this whole spy plot. And William Goldman, the famous screenwriter, who a lot of people think wrote the whole screenplay, but he says all he did was read a version where the FBI and the CIA were involved trying to get Will Hunting's like genius stuff. And he was like, just cut all that and leave the stuff that's around it. And they're like, but that's the story. And he was just like, yeah, no, I know, but that's what actually works about your thing. Or yeah, Elvis just doing a bit, like Elvis was doing bits in the studio. And yeah, they're like, Elvis, you're crazy. And then like a guy walking by the recording booth was like, that's a hit. And it's like nonsense accidents.
Yeah, there was the Space Odyssey one too, right? The music.
Yeah, that was a great
example.
Was
just a placeholder. I mean, I feel bad for the guy who was hired to do it, his music was just not included, but then it ended up making the movie better.
Yeah, 2001 A Space Odyssey has like all these iconic pieces of classical music that's like kind of the thing that you picture when you picture 2001 Space Odyssey is like these spacecrafts like slowly kind of moving in choreographed motion with like these classic pieces of classical music by...
I think it's Strauss, right?
Yeah. Of course it's Strauss. I knew that. I was going to say Mozart or Bach or Beethoven. One of those, one of the three that I know. But yeah, he put that there as a placeholder and they were having music composed. And at a certain point he was just like, ah, fuck it. Let's just leave it. And that ends up being like kind of the best part. Kubrick uses music like beautifully in his movies. And none of those decisions were made by him. It was usually his daughter.
Really?
Oh. Yeah. Which, if you think about it, like, he was, like, kind of an old stodgy dude who wasn't, like, up on rock music or anything. So, like, his daughter would just come in and had really good taste in music.
Because with him with music, I also think of Clockwork Orange, where it's really heavy on Beethoven.
Right.
But that's sort of a decision by the writer. Like, it's all written in how much he loves Beethoven, so Kubrick just puts in Beethoven.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's a thing that happens a lot in music, sort of these accidental things. Sweet Child of Mine. Is that like considered a classic song?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I think so. The big GNR.
Classic rock.
Played at high school football games. That, barometer.
That riff is a finger stretching exercise that Slash was doing. And Axl was really high and was like, that's our song. And they weren't like, Axl, you crazy. They listened to him or were scared enough of him. Beastie Boys Fight for Your Right to Party was them making fun of their douchebag fans and like kind of frat boys, and that ends up being like their anthem. And like Beck Loser was like him just goofing around in someone's kitchen with a acoustic guitar. So yeah, everything's an accident. Nothing's planned, or all the good stuff is an accident. It's like you have these brilliant accidents that happen that make great art, and then like people just make derivative stuff from then until somebody else makes a big enough mistake that like there's great art created again.
Oh, from all these, it seems like the lesson, if you're a creative person, is be ready to hear the note. Your things that you do on purpose are not good.
Right.
The things you do by mistake are great. The things you did on purpose are bad. And be ready to just say, I accept. And then once that happens, all your mistakes will make you famous and rich and happy and wealthy.
You see that in comedy a lot, too, because it's not necessarily that the stuff you do on purpose is bad. It's just that there's so much of it. So even if it's good, so many people are doing the same thing. You know, you can study all you want. Like one example is comedian Kyle Ayers. He had this hashtag roof breakup that went viral. Yeah. He was a very funny comedian before that, but that's what put him on the map. You see that a lot with, do you guys know Zach Broussard? He had this 1,000 comedians you should know list. And when he started it, it was just, he did a Tumblr post to make fun of lists. And it went viral. And now he's been doing that as his thing. You know, these are all comedians are very funny as comedians in their own right. But then it took some accident when they were just like, I don't know about comedy. Here's a thing. And that's what made them known as comedians.
Is Zach Broussard the guy who did the SoCal Comedy Festival?
Yes, yeah. So since then, I think he's been doing more, realizing like, oh, this is something I can try to repeat. But the first one is always the biggest hit because it's not on purpose and nobody is expecting it.
The bit is that he's the authority on comedy or something?
So the joke was, originally he just made a list on Tumblr of 1,000 comedians, including like everyone from like open micers to Carrot Top was on it. And it became a big thing because people shared it and some people actually reacted to it like they would a list.
Right.
So it was the very thing he was satirizing of how lists don't matter. People shared it like, I can't believe I'm not on this list. This person's on this list. Right. Rich Voss called him and got angry on his podcast. Yeah, so it was a whole thing. And the joke was just that it doesn't matter. It's so arbitrary. He's just a guy.
And the SoCal Comedy Festival is playing with the thing of people are very precious about their credits and about having certain, I've been on this festival and that festival. So the SoCal Comedy Festival is a comedy festival you get into just by submitting.
Oh.
That you would like to be in it. And right. then you get into it and you can put it on whatever you want.
Right.
It's not a real festival.
He's performed at the SoCal Comedy Festival.
Right.
Is there an actual event or it's just like a thing?
He made actual... No, there was no actual performances. And he made it very clear on his site. There are no real performances.
Right.
But there were posters. He
That's
did this
so
whole
funny.
Thing during the week of the actual festival.
Yeah.
He had Facebook events and like fake after party events, making it very clear on all of them that they weren't happening.
That's such a good point about originality, because I think a really underrated thing is how similar people's ideas are to one another, like that other people are having the same thoughts as you because we're all reacting to the same stimulus. And like we've covered on the podcast before and on the site, like how two people, one in England and one in America, invented the character Dennis the Menace on the same day in like 1941.
Oh, wow.
Completely independently, both characters were like rascally little kids with like striped t-shirts. And it's just like, there's so many people reacting to the same world and our brains are all pretty much the same. So the stuff you do on purpose is going to feel very similar. And I mean, sometimes that's what's great about art is like you're calling out the thing that people have thought before. But other times, like to be truly original, like it can't be something that you did on purpose because that's the thing that everybody else is doing.
Right. It's funny because we criticize people for not being original, but like you said, our brains are the same. And you think about, we all figured out just on a basic level how to, you know, open a banana to eat. And someone out there probably thought, wow, I figured it out. And that's a very basic level, but you figure out life things the same way you might figure out art or responding to stimulus. So you might think someone's copying your idea, but really it's like, well.
There's this philosophical thought I had when I was like, in eighth grade, and like, I think getting secondhand high for the first time, I was like, what if the colors you see aren't the colors that I see? We just have the same word, but we're seeing different colors. And like, I have since had like 30 people say that to me and like said that they had that exact same philosophical thought. And like, I thought I was like, you know, being crazy mind blowing.
Well, the South Park writers, I think, say that they always throw out, if two people in the writer's room have the same idea, they just immediately throw it out, or the same joke, even if it's really good and it makes people laugh, because it just means that
it was too easy.
Yeah.
Speaking of the South Park writers, Monet, the whole impressionism movement came from, it has nothing to do with the South Park.
I was like, this is not a real transition.
Yeah, like,
which kid is Monet? Oh, God.
The whole impressionism thing came from the fact that he had cataracts. We've talked about this before, but it's like so cartoonish. It's like he saw things blurry and so painted them blurry and people were like, whoa, like what an original idea. And it was just like an accident of like his eyes being fucked up. And then when he got surgery that fixed it for a time, he was like, oh my God, my paintings suck. Like those are fucking terrible. Look how blurry they are. And like destroyed $20 million worth of Monet's of his own work just because like, you know, he was pissed that his paintings were blurry, but that is the sort of accident that creates an entire direction for art.
I feel like that's an interesting phenomenon of artists who want to either destroy their work because they think it's bad, or they say, burn this when I die, or something like that. I think that happens a lot with authors. Didn't Kafka want all of his writing destroyed? And then I think Mark Twain, when he wrote Letters from the Earth, it was seen as sort of sacrilegious at the time because it's Lucifer writing up to heaven about what's going on Earth. But he was like, don't publish this until long after I'm dead. But it's one of his best things. It's amazing.
Yeah, I want my Twitter drafts folder destroyed.
Your Twitter drafts folder is now very intriguing because you're putting it on level with Kafka's entire body of work and Twain's Letters from Earth.
But because they're all wrong about their stuff.
Right.
Like they all think, these are my worst ideas. But luckily, their wife or someone in their life saves the manuscript and publishes it. And then it's what they're known for.
Yeah, with Kafka, I've always heard that his brother disregarded his will and like kept him published them. But I've also heard that, so the idea was that like he never published and was only posthumously appreciated. But then I've also heard the anecdote that when Kafka read his work in front of crowds at the time that he was alive, it was considered comedy and like there was like lots of laughter. So those are both great anecdotes that can't exist in the same universe. They can't both be true. But it is true that people suck at judging their own work.
Well, I think there's a sense of, as an artist, needing control. Not saying I'm an artist, but just in general, like...
You're
just,
an artist.
Thank you. Teresa. I'm a clam. They they need this control. So when you put something out that you're proud of, there's a sense of like, okay, I've done everything I can and it's perfect. But that's when it's not actually living, because these things people are ashamed of tend to be more representative of what's actually on the inside. But there's a sense of, oh no, I gave it away too soon. I haven't had a chance to like edit it. And yeah, a lot of artists, like Camille Claudel also destroyed her statues and stuff. And just a lot of people get angry at not being able to control it and then just being like, nobody can have this.
The Simpsons kind of came out of an attempt to control. So Matt Groening, is that how it's pronounced?
I think so.
Matt Groening was about to meet with James L. Brooks, and he had this entire pitch for a animated series about his comic Life in Hell, right? Yeah. And literally while in the waiting room about to meet with James L. Brooks, he was like, oh shit, I don't want to like give away the rights to this comic because this is going to be the greatest thing I ever create. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to give it away to some Hollywood hack. So in the waiting room, he like sketched out The Simpsons and was like, okay, my parents' names, Homer and Marge.
Right.
And instead of Matt, I'll call him Bart because he's a brat. And I just switched those letters around. And that's how The Simpsons were created in like 2 minutes right before a pitch, like out of desperation and like just sheer mind-blowing laziness. But the thing that came to him in that moment of desperation was the thing that was like the easiest for him to create. And sometimes that's like, I know that like a lot of the best things that I've written were things that I was like, didn't think were good. I just thought they were too easy. You know, it's like, oh, well, everybody knows that or something like that. It's like the things that are a lot of work are never the best things that I do.
Yeah. And it's hard to get out of your own way, especially I know in my head, I want to have a feeling that I put as much effort into it as possible. That means I made it good. That means I did it right. But I have to fight that a little bit because then sometimes that means you overwork it and overthink it. And
yeah. Mario and Donkey Kong. So that's an interesting story. There's this publishing company, I think, that had the rights to Popeye and Olive Oil, and Nintendo had them at a certain point. And so they were like, make a Popeye and Bluto and Olive Oil game. So that's the original Donkey Kong. Like Donkey Kong was Bluto, the princess was Olive Oil, and Jumpman was Popeye. So they made like a pocket game that was basically that. And then they were like, try it for the arcade. And then the people who had the license were like, ah, never mind. You guys are garbage, and took it away from them. And so they were like, all right, what's the easiest thing to animate? Overalls. So they gave him like red overalls. They were like, his face, if you ever look at like 8-bit animation, like you really can't see anything. It's just like an orange blob. And so they give him a mustache, and like all these things were just last second things that they threw in. I forget, like Donkey Kong, I think the word for gorilla in Japanese is like similar to Bluto or something like that. And so they just like threw that in there. But yeah, it was all just accidental and like doing it to cover up a mistake. And it's like the most valuable intellectual property in our video game universe.
Man, Popeye would be the biggest character of all time if he was all the Mario games and also Popeye.
Right. Yeah, and if you think about it, like Mario like gets a mushroom in this case instead of spinach and like grows strong. So like a lot of it is very Popeye-esque.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, but also the drawing board. If we can't use spinach, how about psychoaffective drugs? Let's do that.
Yeah,
very
yeah.
similar.
Hey guys, we're listening to 22
parentheses, over soon, bracket, Bob Moose extended cab version. I don't know if that's that different from the album version. It's by Bon Iver. It's a great song. I've not really gotten into him much before this year, but this latest album has really interesting production. Almost feels like it's his Kid A, Amnesiac, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot type thing. And I wanted to play something off this album because the album's about God. The lyrics in this song have the lines, "I've carried consecration and then you expelled all decision," which in the lyric book, the "you" is capitalized. So it seems like you might be talking about God there. And Drake also started this episode out rapping about his success being all God's doing and how you can't plan it. And I've always wondered about that, like the relationship between successful people and faith in God. It seems like a lot of artists and geniuses who I wouldn't have necessarily expected to be religious, when you hear them interviewed, they're like, "Oh yeah, of course there's a God. I have a great relationship with God. We're tight." And I always found that strange, assuming that God isn't actively interfering with human events, like to give people who have faith in him more money. I don't think even the experts on God stuff, as the Pope's business card no doubt says, claim that's how God works. But I always thought it was curious that there would be anything but like a negative correlation between believing in God and genius, since for most of my life, I believed they were empirically, obviously wrong about the biggest question. Anyways, thinking about this week's conversation and this week's music, I think gave me some insight into that question. I think all artists have the instinct to kind of control things, but as we discussed, the more they control every aspect of the creative process, the more they end up creating stuff that's derivative. You'd think the more they control something, the more original to them it would become. But I do really believe that we're all more similar to each other on the inside than we like to think. And the more you think you're creating something nobody else could have possibly thought of, the more you're going to get something everybody else could have probably thought of. But the more they let outside influences in and accidents in, the more original it becomes, the less like other people's work it becomes. And I wonder if having faith that everything's in God's hands and that you can't plan everything keeps you from planning the spontaneity and accidents and mistakes out of whatever you're creating. Anyways, hope you enjoy this song and these words from our sponsors. This episode of the Crack Podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Whether you're planning to start a business, change careers, launch a creative project in the new year, however you're planning to conquer the world, you're going to want to do it with Squarespace. And just from a user perspective, Squarespace provides an awesome, unique experience that's fully transparent, incredibly easy to set up, and you can add and arrange your content and features just by using your mouse or a trackpad if you're nasty. And yeah, it's really that easy. There's no coding required. You don't have to install anything or upgrade anything ever. All the hard work is just automatically done for you behind the scenes. And if you ever have questions, it doesn't matter how technical or trivial, you can turn to Squarespace's award-winning 24/7 customer support. So start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED to get 10% off your first purchase. Again, that's squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED for 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, make your next move, make your next website. This episode is also brought to you by HBO and the new season of Real Time with Bill Maher. The new season premieres this Friday, the 20th at 10 p.m. live on HBO.
Bill and his rotating panel of guests are back for season 15 of HBO's award-winning series, and if our new leader keeps creating news, there will probably be plenty to talk about. And that leader is, of course, the young Pope. No, of course, it's Trump. Though you never know what that young Pope is going to do next. Saw a picture of him the other day. Red shoes. Can you believe it? But seriously, it's a great show that's always a topic of conversation on Monday mornings. There's something in each episode that's either hilarious or thought-provoking or infuriating or just straight-up awesome. Like any time he has Killer Mike on, it's great. So check out Real Time with Bill Maher live Fridays at 10 p.m. only on HBO. And each week, the conversation continues with Real Time Overtime on YouTube. So check it out. Star Wars, just in general, is like the biggest clusterfuck of all. Or like, it's just
yeah,
like
that movie stinks. Yeah, I hate it.
We give Lucas credit, or at least we did heading into the prequels. Like, if you see the behind the scenes for the first prequel, it's like they're like, George, whatever you say, you're such a genius. And his initial instincts on Star Wars were like really off. And like, he just happened to luck into like really great studio notes, which is not like a cool thing to say, but the studio kind of reined in his dumbest ideas. And then there are just these like incredibly talented people. For instance, the sound designer, a guy named Ben Burtt, came up with Darth Vader's breathing. That's him breathing through a scuba regulator. The blaster sound, Chewie is a walrus moan layered with like other animal noises. The lightsaber, he like put a electric motor from a movie projector and an old television set next to each other in a room and then like waved a mic around so like it got louder and quieter in time with the scene. So he got the guy who would go on to like do E.T.'s voice and Wally's voice and who discovered the Wilhelm scream. He just happened to luck into that guy being his sound designer. If you like look at even the shots of Star Wars before they had any of the sound effects in place, it's like completely ridiculous. Darth Vader like speaks like this. He like speaks like an angry, effeminate guy. So it's just like all these things having to come together and go right for something that great to be created.
I think I've also heard that George's wife at the time helped with the edit or even did the editing and fixed it in a lot of ways in post. Which is also probably true of a lot of movies where the editor, either working with the director or not, sort of saves it. But that's not one where you think of, at least I thought George Lucas, as a kid, I thought George Lucas was the guy who made
right.
it all, really.
Yeah.
And in particular, because the way I first consumed Star Wars was a 3 VHS set. Before each movie, there was an interview where George Lucas talked to Leonard Maltin, and they just got way into how smart George Lucas is every time, and how he would say, like, oh, I had a plan for the entire thing the whole way, which is not true. And it was all bullshit. But as a kid, I just thought, okay, I mean, it's his movie. He must have made it, and he must be a genius. Great.
Yeah. So the original Star Wars script, and even, like, they started production under the name Adventures of Luke Starkiller, as taken from the Journal of the Wills, Saga 1, The Star Wars. And they were like, cut 90% off of that bullshit before and just use the last two words.
Right. Fiona Apple wrote the title. That's right. Awesome.
Based on the novel Push by Sci-Fi.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And he always says, like, Darth Vader means Dark Father, and, like, he had that plan all along. In that version, like, the version of the script that they, like, started shooting, Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker's father, like, fight each other, like, in a scene. So it's like, he didn't know what the fuck he was doing.
Wasn't there also a plan for Han Solo to be an alien?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah, there's like a description.
Terrible idea.
Let me see if I can find that description. It's really funny.
Just an unimaginable movie with Han Solo. It's like if Greedo was Han Solo. It wouldn't make any sense.
He looks exactly like Greedo. Yeah. If those were just two identical people. Like
yeah. That face can't do a cool wink. You can't get that out of that.
This is how he was described in the first draft of the script. The 8-foot Chewbacca, who resembles a huge gray bush baby with fierce baboon-like fangs, struggles to free his companions. General Skywalker embraces Han Solo, the underground contact. Han is a huge green-skinned monster with no nose and large gills. My vision for Han was always... He was the bad boy.
Right.
Yeah, no nose and gills.
Right, he's the creature from the Black Lagoon.
It's yeah, he looks exactly like, yeah. And Jabba the Hutt was, he was basically fat bastard. He was an overweight Scottish guy. And
Yeah. And they filmed some of that, right?
They did.
They had a guy in like a fur stole talking to Han Solo right. in the hangar.
Yeah, and then they were like, ooh, this doesn't quite work out. Yeah, but they didn't know who was going to be an alien and who was going to be a person at all. And if you think about it, it's pretty arbitrary. They're just like, yeah, that's a person. That guy's a weird blob of, he looks like a slug.
Yeah, even the robots could have just been people or aliens, or you know, it's all whatever they want.
The thing I was trying to remember earlier was just like what a complete mess Raiders was behind the scene. I think everybody knows that Tom Selleck was supposed to be Indiana Jones. That was their first pick, and they like almost stopped production when they couldn't get Tom Selleck because he was shooting Magnum PI. So they end up begrudgingly casting Harrison Ford, who was like so fucking perfect. But the shoot is like a complete disaster. They're shooting in Tunisia. It's 130 degrees out and everybody has dysentery. Oh my God. So everybody's like incredibly sick. John Rhys Davies shit himself in his costume, like on the set. It's a great piece of trivia. I'm sure he's glad is out there. And Harrison Ford was really close to doing the same on the day that he was supposed to shoot this like sword fight with this guy who was like a master swordsman.
Yeah.
And he was like, I've got an idea. Why doesn't the guy do all his sword tricks and then I just shoot him? Because like he was so sick. And Spielberg was like, I guess, fine. And that's like one of the iconic scenes, and it's like so perfect for Indiana Jones. It like sums him up completely. And it was just because Harrison Ford had to shit really bad.
Oh my God. Yeah, there was also in one of the articles you sent a story about The Usual Suspects that similarly related to shitting. The scene when they get lined up that...
Speaking of Monet,
yeah, right. It was that someone had to fart really bad. Do you remember this? Okay, I'll find it. It was in one of the articles, The Usual Suspects in the lineup scene, the reason that rapport works so well and they're all laughing, that originally was supposed to be very serious.
Oh, right.
But one of the actors had really bad gas and was farting the whole time. So then everyone was just like, couldn't keep a straight face.
It was Benicio Del Toro.
Okay, it was Benicio. Brett was like trying to jump in there. But yeah, so that's why they had such a good rapport. And it set up the movie for, this is why it makes sense that they all decided to become friends.
Yeah. Benicio Del Toro came on that movie and everybody else was like, okay, we're here to do work. We're professionals. And he came and was like, I'm going to just like fuck around and like basically prank this movie. That's like a giant career opportunity for me. And he like came and did that voice and nobody had asked him to do that voice. They were like, what the fuck are you, like nobody can understand you. And he was like, no, this is the way the guy talks. And he was like farting during the lineup scene. And like they were supposed to be like gangsters who hated each other. And then in that scene, that whole kind of back and forth where they were like kind of laughing with one another, that whole energy was just created by Benicio Del Toro doing a stupid voice and farting. It's like, it's like be a 5-year-old and like that's how you create movie magic.
I wonder where he got that voice. One of my favorite comedy character anecdotes is that Triumph the Insult Comic Dog is a character Robert Smigel does on Conan and things. He has a really weird voice. It's like a really crazy Eastern European accent thing. Right. And there's an interview with Andy Richter where he says that one time they asked Robert, like, why does Triumph talk with that accent? And Robert's answer was, that's simply the accent all dogs have. Which is bananas. It makes no sense at all. But he just locked into that and it really works for no clear reason. He just got past his own head.
That's amazing. Let's read some really weird things from early first drafts of scripts, like how they were intended when they were greenlit by the studio. So in the original version of Alien, Ripley was a man. And that might seem like kind of a not that big of a tweak, but when you think about like how much of that movie is aimed at terror about like male rape. It was like really on the surface level. Like the part where everybody wakes up from their coma nap thing. In the script, it says, slowly, groggily, six nude men sit up next to each other. There's like this one scene where, so they all have really fucking stupid names. Chaz Standard, Jay Faust, and Cleve Hunter. And let me just read this one scene.
I want to check into a hotel as Chaz Standard. Yeah, Standard. Sounds great.
Standard turns and looks at him. For a long moment, the two men regard each other. Then Standard steps forward and slaps Roby across the face. The others are shocked. Hunter, hey now, what is this? Standard, ask him. Roby slowly puts his hand to his cheek. I understand why you did that. It's like this like really like maudlin romantic thing. And yeah, it was just like very surface level homoerotic stuff rather than like kind of that sneaking up on you. Also, the spaceship was called Snark, and Snark. Earth was spelled IRTH in that version of the future. In the first draft of Back to the Future, Marty and Professor Brown, as he was known, run a video bootlegging business selling illegally copied porn to high school students. And then there's this weird thing with Coca-Cola where like they keep pouring Coca-Cola on like inventions and contraptions, and like that's the secret ingredient instead of plutonium to like,
oh boy.
Yeah, it's just like a weird ad for a Coke, which is weird because right. It ended up being an ad for Pepsi, but.
Because now I'm imagining all the dialogue was, you mean Coca-Cola will work? Yes, Coca-Cola.
It really
Coca-Cola.
Is.
Coca-Cola.
It's so bizarre. Okay, The Matrix, the dialogue is really brutal. So first of all, The Matrix in the movie is a actual like chat room where people hang out. So here's the chat room back and forth. Quark, The Matrix is a euphemism for the government. Superastic? No, The Matrix is the system controlling our lives. Timax, you mean MTV? Superastic. I mean Sega. Phosphor. All hail Sega. It's like, yeah. What?
Hold on, you can't just spring those character names on me like that. What? And Quark then, and time Rat?
Quark, Superastic, Timax, and Phosphor.
It's like if I tried to write a movie about Snapchat now.
Yes,
like
that's exactly.
Like, we're really hip. Look, right. We're going to talk like the kids do.
And then...
we are the filters, man.
Right. Yeah. Then Neo says, fucking idiots, don't know shit. And... You can cram that file up your secret service sphincter.
Ooh, burned.
And then there's this really good exchange. Gizmo, goddamn, what I wouldn't give for a copy of that software. Trinity turns around. Gizmo, you don't have the hardware to handle this software.
Oh, my God.
No.
No.
Yep. That was the original version of The Matrix. And the ending is amazing, so... In the script, Agent Smith still shoots Neo, but in the first draft, instead of stopping bullets with his mind and destroying Agent Smith with like his newfound powers, Neo gets hit, rises from the dead, and then just flips Smith the bird. And yeah, this actual script says, Neo gives him the finger, Agent Smith. No! And then instead of shooting him, he's like in an elevator and the elevator doors are already closing as Neo gives him the bird. And so like that's what saves him is elevator doors closing faster than Agent Smith, who can like time warp. He like can't stick his hand in the door to like stop the elevator doors from closing.
I actually heard the original Matrix was actually Spy Kids. He was a 13-year-old.
Oh, really?
Neo
oh.
Was 13. Yeah, so it makes sense. He's a 13-year-old boy.
Wow.
And that's why he's flipping the bird.
Oh, nice. He's like Macaulay Culkin, red. Like, he's a bad dude who is totally to the extreme.
Parents suck.
Yeah. The bad guy, the emperor in the original draft of Star Wars was named COSDASHIT. Cause da shit.
What?
Yep.
What?
In the original draft of the script, on a huge austere platform stands the dark Cos Dashit, Lord of Alderaan.
Were they sneaking in cursing intentionally?
I don't know. Cos Dashit, maybe? Yeah. Written by a 10-year-old.
I don't know. Maybe there's a heartening lesson. If you're somebody who creates things and think, hearing these original scripts, I feel like the lesson is, in order to make a movie as good as Aliens or Star Wars or something, you don't actually have to know how to write it. You just need to know how to write something and then have the humility to take notes. Right. That's all you need to do. It's put something down and then have other brains who can get outside because they're not you, like, fix it for you.
And by the way, George Lucas didn't have the humility. If you like see the on set documentaries, he's like just bitching about like all the notes he's getting from the studio and stuff. It's like, they're ruining my vision. So we have this article, 5 pop culture moments that were improvised. And the amazing thing is just like how bad the ideas were before they like saved them with these improvisations. Like, the Vulcan salute was supposed to be the peace sign, and Leonard Nimoy came up with the Vulcan salute on the set because he was like, that's fucking stupid, man. People are going to be really mad at us if we have him giving the peace sign.
And isn't that one where he pretty rapidly on the fly, without overthinking it, thought of something else? He just thought, this is a hand symbol that means a Hebrew letter or word, I believe.
And right, then, with two hands originally, I think.
Yeah. How about that? And it's great. Right. It feels somehow authentic to this Vulcan culture that none of us actually know about.
And that's the sort of thing that you could totally see being like noted to death, like right, in a right. focus group. Like, okay, what about parting the fingers this way? No, what about parting it?
Right. Just some focus group member is like, I like cool handshakes. What about that? And then that's that.
Mickey Mouse was originally, and like very late into the process, named Mortimer Mouse. And this is another case of his wife saving his ass. She was like, I don't think that name's very good. And instead of being like, how about anything else? She was just like, how about Mickey? And thus history was created. Scooby-Doo was just like a fucking terrible show in concept. It was about a musical band that went around and they had a dog named Too Much. Like T-O-O-M-U-C-H.
Like the Spice Girls song?
Yeah. It was named after that. Yeah, I think. Yeah. And they got the name Scooby-Doo from Sinatra improvising at the end of Strangers in the Night. They were like, oh, those are words that I'm hearing right now. Let me type that into my screenplay.
Kids love scat. Let's do some of that.
This actually happens a lot with video games. Like Laura Croft, I guess this isn't the most defining aspect of her, but it is a notable aspect that she has like gigantic cone-shaped boobs. And that was like an errant mouse click that put the decimal point in the wrong place. So like they were supposed to make it 10% bigger and they made it 100% bigger. And like everybody in the room was like, that, do that, that one's good, that's the good one.
I feel like I like to imagine the guy doing it, that's just his story to cover up, but he was secretly like at home like, you know what, I'll fix it later, I'm just gonna have some fun. And then he got caught and he was like, it was an accident.
I mean to.
It's better, right?
I like your impression of guys. The idea of video games becoming increasingly more difficult as you go, which seems like the most obvious thing in the world, was accidentally invented because Space Invaders, you know, the game where like there's a certain number of things on the board and as you shoot them, they get faster. The reason they got faster at first was because there were fewer of them, and so it took less computing power for them to move around. And so the computer just automatically moved them faster. And that's how the idea to make games more difficult as you went on was invented.
We were talking about character design stuff before, and I really like the story with Kirby because when they were designing Kirby, they didn't know what to make the hero of the game look like, so they just put in a sphere. And then the more they tested it and used it, they just really liked the sphere. So then they gave it feet and that was it. That was
and his name was different too, right?
Yeah, apparently in the early stages, this was a mistake on their part, I feel, because in the early stages, his name was Popopo, which is, I wish they'd kept so it Popopo. It's great.
There's a lot of weird things that happened on the set of Lord of the Rings. To Viggo Mortensen in particular, like he like broke his foot by kicking something in reaction to like finding out one of the dwarves, I don't know, I haven't seen those movies, but and he like, he like cries and screams, and like that was because he had actually just broken his foot. And there's a part where he almost nearly drowned because he was like in a river and like his armor was too heavy. Movie I have seen being John Malkovich, the part where he gets pegged in the head by a beer can, that was an accident. There was just a drunk extra who like threw a beer can at his head like as they were driving by, which seems insane.
Yeah, there's a lot of people getting hurt for real.
Right.
But then making it into the movie.
Wasn't one of them, it's Back to the Future 3, they in the hanging where Marty McFly, they actually hung Michael J. Fox briefly. He almost died.
Yeah, it's funny because like you always read that they did like 5 takes and then on the 5th one, something went wrong with the thing and like he almost died. And then they're like, and that's the one they used because it really works well.
Pretty convincing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Inglourious Bastards, when Diane Kruger is being strangled, that's Quentin Tarantino actually doing the strangling, because we write in the article, we think that maybe that movie was all just an excuse for him to act out his fetish of dressing up as a Nazi and like strangling Diane Kruger.
Oh my God.
But yeah, he like had this really specific vision and like strangled her until she almost passed out. The chest waxing in 40-Year-Old Virgin was real. Mm. Have you guys seen Old Boy?
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't. No.
He ate an actual live octopus for that.
Oh,
wow. Oh yeah. And isn't the story that the actor is vegetarian?
Yeah.
So
a Buddhist, like vegetarian for like ethical reasons. And then basically every Sylvester Stallone movie, he does his own stunts and just gets the living shit kicked out of him. In Rocky IV, him and Dolph Lundgren were actually like wailing on each other. And Dolph Lundgren punched him so hard that like his heart stopped beating in rhythm. And
yeah. And is that bad?
Yeah, you're okay. Supposed to have like a rhythm. It's supposed to. He was in the hospital for 9 days after that. And he also, Stone Cold Steve Austin, broke his neck in The Expendables.
Oh, and the Inglourious Bastard, there's another one. The set caught fire for real. And then the scene where the theater's burning down, a lot of that's actual. Like the set just came apart and it wasn't supposed to be that big, but it's such a cool scene.
Yeah. Eli Roth almost burned to death. In that scene, he had to be rushed
to
the hospital.
Right?
Yeah. Manufacturing real terror seems to be like a method that directors like to do. Hitchcock did it in a way that could be considered a war crime. In Birds, he like tied a bird to the face of the main actress and like had her like get scratched up by it. But like in more humane examples of that tactic, in the Alien chestburster scene, they didn't tell anybody what was going to happen. They just knew that the alien emerged and they had the actor hooked up to a body. So everybody thought it was his body. And then they had actual like pig intestines and stuff and sprayed them with blood. And like one of the actors like almost had a heart attack. And the woman who like starts crying and like has a breakdown, like was really having an actual breakdown because they just like weren't prepared for that in the least.
It seems like if you act in movies, you should make your decisions on which parts to take based on which of these plots would I actually want to experience in real life.
Right.
Which would I live through for real?
Blair Witch Project was basically real. All they did was give these actors video cameras and like starved them, put them in the woods. Oh. And then they just told them to keep filming and then would like sneak up on them and like rattle their tent and like do all this like really creepy shit and like deprive them of sleep so that they were like really legitimately at the end of their wits by the end of the movie. And then they actually killed those people.
I was gonna say that sounds like that. I want to see a horror movie. Well, I don't because I don't watch horror movies, but someone should do a horror movie about someone making a horror movie. And it's, you think the actors go in and it's like, well, it's all fake. But then it's
I think they did that with like Scream 4 or 3 or whatever. Kramer versus Kramer, the final scene when she's like, how do I look? And he's like, you look amazing or something. They were just rolling before the scene. And she was just saying that because she had like lipstick on her teeth, Meryl Streep. And that ended up being what they used to like close out the movie. And Pretty Woman, like all the iconic moments, like the jewelry box snapping shut on her hand and like Julia Roberts jumps back and laughs. That was the director, Gary Marshall, was like annoyed at her because she like was out partying every night and was like really kind of low energy on the set. And so he was like, snap it shut on her hand next time to like wake her up and pep her up. And that's where that scene came from.
Yeah, a lot of torturing actors.
Yeah, that's the way to create great art.
Farts and torture.
Farts and torture. Midnight Cowboy, that scene, the I'm walking here scene, that was a real cab that like barreled onto set and almost ran Dustin Hoffman over. My favorite part of Wolf of Wall Street, when Matthew McConaughey is doing that like weird chest thumping thing. That was just a thing that Leonardo DiCaprio was like walking by on set and saw him doing that. And he was like, what the fuck are you doing? He was like, this is just how I get ready for scenes. This is my vocal warm up. And he was like, all right, well, you should do that for the beginning of this thing. Like, that's just Matthew McConaughey being Matthew McConaughey. Easy Rider, this is a great origin story for Jack Nicholson. So Easy Rider, he was supposed to be a producer, and the actor who was going to play his role dropped out at the last minute. And the movie was just like them basically getting high in various locations and like riding motorcycles around. The LSD tripping scene in New Orleans was actual. They were tripping on LSD when they shot it and edited it. So the scene that is basically Nicholson's big scene, they're like sitting around a campfire smoking weed, and like they were all like incredibly high, and like nobody could remember their lines, but he just like nailed his lines perfectly and like was completely high, and also like was not even supposed to be playing that role, like had just found out he was playing that role. But like, I don't know, that makes sense to me, since he's like, first of all, supposedly like always high, like and just like such a pro, he just like accidentally became a legend right there.
I love hearing about stories like that, when people accidentally fall into big roles and you're like, they're a star. But at the same time, they also frustrate me, because especially like in an industry where everyone's like, you got to work hard and try hard. And then it's like, but if you don't want it enough, it'll just come to you. And those stories are so frustrating.
I think you probably worked pretty hard prior to that.
No, for sure. I'm sure he was there
to get
a
himself in the right place at the right time.
But yeah, but they're always spun in a way that's like, they're an outsider. We like them.
Well, I do think that that's like the story we like to tell ourselves, because it's like for the same reason people like to tell themselves that Einstein failed math in high school, which when asked about that rumor, Einstein was like, I had a pretty complete understanding of like theoretical physics by age 12. But people like that because it makes it seem like more attainable, and also makes it seem like, oh, those people, they're not so great. They're just like me, except they were in the right place at the right time.
Well, and also with movies specifically, I feel like we all want every movie to be The Revenant, or a movie like it where you're watching the movie and then you have the backstory of he really was in the woods for years and years and it was terrible and he froze his face off and a bear ate him, you know.
Right.
But in actuality, a lot of movies, they just acted. But it was fine.
All right, so lightning round of things that were complete accidents. Some of these are good accidents. Some of these made the movie probably slightly worse. So The Fifth Element, one of the most notable things from that movie, I'll say, is Chris Tucker's unhinged performance. That role was specifically written for Prince. There was like some misunderstanding between him and the French costume designer, and Prince was like, nah, I'm out of here, and just like bailed. Which that just like makes way more sense of that to me, like why that character was there.
I like to imagine that Prince has never said goodbye in a social situation.
Yeah.
He's just gone.
Absolutely gone. Not. Yeah. Where'd Prince go? What's that cloud of smoke right there? What? Sister Act, this makes a lot of sense to me. So Sister Act was originally meant for Bette Midler, which makes sense because Bette Midler is actually like a singer, mm-hmm. and I don't think Whoopi Goldberg was, right? She wasn't known
as
a singer prior to that.
I don't think so.
And you can see the change in casting, that they didn't really adapt the script to that, because at the end, there's like all these parts where Whoopi Goldberg is the only black nun in like a sea of 40 other white nuns. And the gangsters who are after her are like, I can't find her. Which one is she? Like, she's blending in with all the other ones. It's like, Linda Hamilton beat the living shit out of the kind of chubbier orderly in Terminator 2 because he kept pulling his punches during their first fight scene. And so it made it hard for her to act like she was being hit. And so she kept having to like drop to her knees every time she got fake hit by this guy. But like he wouldn't hit her because she was a woman. And so when it was her turn, she just like destroyed his face. And you can like hear James Cameron like behind the scenes in the commentary on the DVD being like, real hit, ha ha ha. And it's like, Jesus Christ. He's like, his face was broken. It was hilarious.
Oh my God. There's two things I love. It's the sea and real hits.
Right.
I'm James Cameron.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. There was just like all sorts of real explosions. A train almost decapitated Clint Eastwood. Horses just like running all over the set and like nearly trampling people. The French Connection, really famous car chase. There's like one part where there was just a car that like barreled onto set. Again, they didn't do a good job of like blocking off the road, and it like T-bones Gene Hackman's car. And like that was an actual accident. The person you see in that car was like some random citizen who like happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Never heard from again, weirdly. A Clockwork Orange, we mentioned before, but basically everyone got the shit kicked out of them. The eye clamp things were real and like actually scratching his corneas the whole time. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I just recommend listening to the DVD commentary for that. Or I think actually Sarge just made a Cracked Interrupts that has some of the commentary track in it, because the actors and the director worked, I guess, 27 hours in a row, and everybody was like unhinged, and they had like live chainsaws, and yeah, people just essentially went completely insane. Do you have any that you want to call out?
I like the Daniel Craig one from Casino
Royale.
Yeah,
that one's amazing, right?
Like the iconic shot of him coming out of the water. It was an accident because he hit a rock or something.
He hit a sandbar.
Yeah, and then he had to stand up.
Yeah.
And people thought it was a tribute to the original James Bonds.
It was like, now this guy's the hot one instead of the woman.
And he got, praise for that. But it's just, it was just like, no, there's a thing.
Yeah. He just was like awkwardly standing up on a sandbar.
I hope he got up there and he said, oh, this is going to be my number one Google image search now, right? Yeah. Okay. Number one. All right.
The extra on Wolf of Wall Street shaving her head, that was an actual hair and makeup person who they just paid to shave her head. I think that happens a lot because I don't think there's a very good way to like fake shaving your head. So like, I remember reading that at the beginning of Full Metal Jacket, the opening to that movie is all of them getting their hair shaved off. And that was like actually the actors getting their heads shaved and being distraught. Nicole Kidman in everybody's favorite movie, The Paperboy.
It's based on the video game Paperboy?
Yeah. Okay. Zac Efron gets stung by a jellyfish and she actually pees on him. The wrestler, Mickey Rourke, literally cut his face with a razor blade.
Oh. Yeah, right, to get the vibe of those indie wrestlers who will actually cut themselves with blades.
But also, like, on film, when you see him cutting his face, like, he's actually cutting his face.
God.
Yeah, I feel like the way that I can watch, because violence makes me queasy, so the only way I can watch movies like that, but, like, horror and all that stuff is to keep repeating to myself that it's fake, but now you've just taken that away from me, because now I know it's all real.
Yeah, it's all real. That's important to keep in mind.
Every move.
Just a lot of blood, though. In my head, I'll always think, there's no way. This is all fake blood. They just have technology.
Yeah.
But a lot of the times, the little cuts are real. That's what it's sounding like to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Completely real, 100%. This one made a lot of sense to me of Daniel Craig's last Bond movie, Skyfall. I refuse to watch the fourth one. When he goes to the cottage out in his old home, there's like this bearded Scottish guy there, and that was up until very late in the production supposed to be Sean Connery coming out of retirement, which when you go back and watch that, it's like, wait, why the fuck is this happening? Like, why is there an old Scottish guy there? Is it? It's like an Alfred character essentially, but like for no reason. Grand Theft Auto, I guess, was originally a racing game, and just at one point they had a glitch where the cops kept coming every time you sped or like there was a car accident, and like they just realized that it was like really fun to fuck with the cops, and that's how Grand Theft Auto was created.
Yeah, I think the way I read it, the glitch was that the cops tried to drive through your car, so they would just ram you off the road no matter what. And
oh, right.
People loved the disasters.
They were right. They're like, oh, that's fun. Let's stack 30 cops yeah. on top of each other. There's that iconic part of the beginning of Godfather where Luca Brasi is like sitting out waiting to talk to Brando, and he's like rehearsing what he's going to say. That was actually just a bad actor, the guy who played Luca Brasi, who yeah. was just practicing his lines and was like very nervous because it was fucking Brando, and they just filmed him out there like nervously practicing his lines.
That's awesome. Didn't they cast an actual mob guy to be Luca Brasi, or at least somebody who had very little acting experience?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Very little acting experience. And yeah, that ends up being like such a crucial part because it's like this guy who looks big and terrifying is actually the one who's terrified. Like the scary guy is the handsome guy sitting behind the desk.
Spoiler, it makes his death a lot more resonant because he's a real person now. He's not just some
thug. Right. It's like a crucial detail that was just they happened to grab by accident. Back to lightning round. The Omen, the part where the baboons freak out and are trying to kill the kid and the mom is like terrified, that was because she didn't know how to drive a manual transmission and the car stalled out in a baboon cage at the zoo and the baboons really started attacking. So like they were like, oh, this child actor is going to be torn to pieces in front of me. This is really bad. In Goodfellas, there's that scene in the movie. It's Pesci goes back to his house to get a shovel to bury the guy who's like been shot 30 times in his trunk. And while they're there, his mom wakes up and she makes him and De Niro and Ray Liotta meatballs and like this huge meal. And it's like this very Italian thing. It's like a great piece of atmosphere, like we're talking about, like the Luca Brasi thing. So the way Scorsese did that is he cast his actual mom, Scorsese's actual mom, and was like, all you know, mom, is that like your son hasn't been home in a while and he's stopped by to get a shovel, go. And she's like, hey, look at my stupid painting. And I'm like, you boys need to eat. I'm gonna make you some meatballs. It's like more animal madness. In Conan the Barbarian, Arnold was chased and attacked by actual vicious wolves, which is how you got that natural performance from Arnold and Conan. Oh, what an actor. And probably the one of the weirdest ones. This is like so unnecessary. The scene in Billy Madison when Adam Sandler pegs kids in the face with dodgeballs. The night before they shot that scene, he like called the director and was like, I think I'm going to really like peg these kids with dodgeballs tomorrow. So there's like all these cuts in that scene where they like cut away right as the kid's being hit by the ball. And I assumed that was because the kids didn't actually get hit or the balls were like really soft or something. And in the commentary, the director's like, no, we're cutting away because the kids immediately started crying because he was like destroying their faces with like dodgeballs, which I remember thinking it was like one of the funniest scenes when it happened. So maybe it was necessary.
Too real.
In the opening scene of Jaws, the way they made that actress kind of get dragged around in the water by the shark was they tied her to a rig that was underwater and just like dragged her around violently and whipped her back and forth. And she almost broke her back. And then, you know, she like crawled onto shore and was like, Jesus, like I'm never doing anything like that again. And they were like, okay, cool. Can you come to the recording studio? Because we need to get the audio for that. And they waterboarded her for the audio to like get the gurgling sounds. So my favorite movie was created by a war crime. Oh
my God. And who was in charge of machines on that movie?
Right.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible work.
Yeah. You have to just like have some fucking idiot in charge of machines and you end up making a great movie. It's interesting though. I wonder if that movie would have been great because Jurassic Park, like they only don't show the T-Rex for like maybe like one shot and then the T-Rex is there the whole time. I wonder if that movie would have been good if they had done the same thing with the sharks.
Even in Jurassic Park, a lot of the suspense comes from when the kids are running away from, and you know it's just around and the eye shows up. So I think Jaws just did that on a on a level that made it really great.
And then, yeah, there's the nice build with you see the goat getting eaten, but not, you don't actually see it happen. It's just gone, right. That kind of thing.
And the water. Yeah. The cup of water. And then there are all these weird examples where like actors thought they were making a different movie. Like we talked about the Dr. Strangelove thing where he was like, pretend for a second that we're making a comedy, be crazy zany. Carrie's mother in the movie Carrie, Piper Laurie, thought she was making a comedy. And like, that's why her performance is so just like over the top and unhinged. Yeah. Kind of an adorable one. Danny Lloyd, the kid from The Shining, had no idea it was a horror movie. And if you like watch the behind the scenes, it looks like a lot of fun. They're like, okay, now run down the hallway. Now hide in that thing. And he looks like he's having a blast. So in Ben-Hur, apparently Charlton Heston didn't know his character was gay, and neither did I.
I saw that movie for the first time over the holidays. It's like 4 hours, but it's pretty good. And in the movie, the villain ruins Charlton Heston's life. Really, it felt a little out of nowhere to me. It just suddenly he sends him to be a slave in the galleys, and oh, we're done. And then I read, prepping for this, that apparently everyone but Charlton Heston approached it with the intention of the villain as Charlton Heston's ex-gay lover. And so that's why part of why he kind of turns on him and ruins his life. And then Charlton Heston just found out later that that was their intention. Because also when they meet up after many years and there's a lot of like tension to it and a lot of like cuts back and forth to their phases, and the villain is like very excited to see him. But when I was watching it, I had no idea that was what they were going for.
That's so strange.
Yeah.
They just didn't tell the audience either. There's a couple things about Blazing Saddles. First of all, the singer of the theme song didn't know it was a joke. He was like, this is going to be the hit of the 70s. Also, this makes so much sense. The sheriff was supposed to be Richard Pryor. And when you think about it, the movie's written in his voice because he was a screenwriter on the movie. And like all those jokes feel like they're Richard Pryor jokes. And
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. The reason they had to find a different actor to play the sheriff is because he kept bringing cocaine and booze to the read-throughs. And the studio was like, oh, we can't do that. We can't insure him. He's
studio going, notes, right?
Right. What the fuck? And it still ain't a goddamn thing they could tell me. What could compel me to jump in? Get a piece of this bread, pudding, wake up, cake up. Walking in the form of my elders. I'm gloater. Bitch, don't I look like a pharaoh? Fuck your story, tell nigga, pull up. All right, that was our episode. This is Glowed Up, which is a song off the musician, producer Catronata's album, 99.9%. Features Anderson .Paak rapping and singing about drugs. He refers to weed and cocaine and Andy Warhol painting with an eight ball, which is, I think, another way that artists try to introduce controlled errors into their work. That'd be an interesting experiment to look at artists who use drugs versus artists who use God to embrace the chaos of life and art, and see who has the better overall track record. I'd probably put my money on drugs, or at least I definitely would have as a young person. But actually, the more you read about how people like famous geniuses actually worked, a lot of the doing drugs while making art stuff is urban legend and myth. There's that Hemingway quote, write drunk and edit sober, which he never said. What he said is more along the lines of, I'd never write drunk. I'm a fucking professional, you idiots. And then he actually like threw in, Faulkner writes drunk and it's a disgrace. I can see on the page where he's had his first and second drinks, the fucking lush. Anyway, somebody figure that out. Who's sold the most records, God or drugs? Anyways, hope you enjoyed that episode, jam-packed with information. On to some quick footnotes. We are going to link off to a bunch of Cracked articles that we were drawing on. Five famous roles, obviously written for a different actor. Eight times your favorite actor almost died on film. Five iconic pop culture moments improvised at the last second. Six glitches that accidentally invented modern gaming. Six iconic video games that were created by technical problems. Seven characters clearly designed for different famous actors. Six iconic movie scenes that happened by accident. Amazing performances from actors who weren't acting, part one. And we're going to link off to
parts 2 through 5 as well. I think we picked one or two from each of those. We will link off to a Cracked article about actors who weren't acting in their most iconic roles. That's a column by Gladstone. And a article about actors who thought they had made a totally different movie. Everyone was lying to them. That's it for the Cracked articles. We are going to link off to Kyle Ayers' hashtag roof breakup. It's like a series of 50 tweets that Teresa was talking about. Zach Broussard's top 1,000 comedians. And, of course, the SoCal Comedy Fest. That's going to do it for this episode. Thanks to Alex Schmidt and Teresa Lee. And, of course, to engineer Brett, who you can follow at Brett, R-A-D-E-R. You can follow me at Jack_OBRIEN, all those on Twitter. And we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you guys then. Full-time killing, bad hole driller, child for the kitten, mellow yellow lemon, I'm glowed up. I'm glowed up. Yeah, same time stealing, same squad chilling, baggy full of piff. Can't you see I'm living? I'm glowed up. I'm glowed up. Lately I've been glowed up. Paper finally showed up. Charlie got me going buff. I'm feeling like the only one out here. Even if I slowed up, got enough work to last the whole damn. Lately I've been glowed up, feeling like the only one out here. Lately I've been glowed up, paper finally showed up. Shawty got me going buff, feeling like the only one out here. Even if I slowed up, got enough work to last the whole damn life. Lately I've been glowed up. Feeling like the only one out here. This episode was brought to you by Real Time with Bill Maher, which is on live Fridays at 10 p.m. only on HBO. This year, his guests will include authors, thinkers, artists, politicians, and it's always a topic of conversation on Monday mornings. Check it out again, Fridays, 10 p.m. only on HBO.
What if technology could resurrect a late loved one digitally over your phone?
To you, Charlie.
To you, Rossi.
Did you just say the word clink?
Well, I can't really clink the glass, so...
But what if the price of the service was so high it threatened your job, the people around you, even your freedom?
Everyone on the ground! Face down!
You're going away for centuries, and if they ever do release you, whatever comes out of that prison won't be you anymore.
How far would you go to bring someone back to life?
It's weird how sunny it is, Charlie. It's the wrong weather for the terrible thing I'm about to do.
What terrible thing?
Life After, the new drama from Panoply and GE Podcast Theater. Search for Life After, one word, in your favorite podcast app.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.